Oh, I just did that. I forgot why we went over there. There was nothing going on. Nobody paid any attention to you, Sarah. You know, and you just sit there and pick the guitar. Don't expect any sense of community being developed out of your aegis. Aegis. I'm trying to say A-E-G-I-S, under your aegis. You know that word? Your aegis, your control, your sponsorship. Aegis, A-E-G-I-S.
Aegis.
So, this should be fun. New York influence. I've been refined by my experiences in New York City. Basically, Alan is a, he grew up, you know, at the bottom of the social ladder. A bastard, what was he, an orphan and dumped by his parents and on the hustle since he was 16. But he had the brains to make himself relatively cultured in New York terms. So, he's going to celebrate New York like he always does.
Yes, tour New York. Are you going to read the Luckenbach in New York or New York Influence first?
What's the other one?
Luckenbach.
Looks like Luckenbach to me.
Liebach.
Oh, Liebach.
I know, Bert.
I didn't read it. So you didn't get that, you hick? You fucking hick from Switzerland? Dealing with a hip New Yorker or Afghani American.
Don't try to correct
seen
me.
It all. Yeah, seen it all near the tunnel, the Holland Tunnel. Every possible human behavior right there at the Holland Tunnel. But the lie back in New York, I posted some of that or read it. I think I read part of it. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm going to. No, we have to do that with Carolyn. No. We. Collecting Doctors, that's Russ Smith. Yeah, there is a column, but when Carolyn, remind me, if we're still around in the morning, we should do that with Carolyn. Alan Cabal's sort of boss, he did a column recently. So, here we go. Alan Cabal, and this is dated May 22nd. Today, ooh. May 22nd. Or Friday. May 22nd. Much happened yesterday for me. It was a good day. He says, you can take the boy out of Camden, but you can't take Camden out of the boy. As much as I've been refined, it's by my experience in New York City. So far he's saying that he's a jerk or he's a Camden hick. Right? He's still got this Camden in him. But somehow he's been made refined. So, as much as I've been refined, it's by my experiences in New York City. Whatever table manners or other niceties of etiquette I may possess originate in my tenure as a kid actor in New York back in the 1960s. The only sane adults I met during that period were theater people and advertising men. Most of them drank and smoked continuously. A lot of them were gay, hence my love of opera. The aspect of my character that people seem to fear is the part built in Camden, New Jersey. Unlike, say, Lumberton, North Carolina, which is, I think, where Blue Velvet takes place. He mentions that in a recent column, the one we haven't read. Unlike, say, Lumberton, North Carolina, or Lawrence, Kansas. Oh, he went to Lawrence, Kansas in that trip out of New York. The horror in Camden is not concealed by bright green, well-manicured lawns and white picket fences. It's not Baltimore or Oakland with their redeeming arts, restaurants, and business districts. It isn't Compton with its clearly defined borders. It definitely isn't Brooklyn, but it could and should be. It's a lot like Detroit, only worse on a smaller scale. As it is, the horror is right in your face. More than 6 times the national average of violent crimes at a whopping 25.66 per 1,000 people versus the mediocre national average of 3.8 per 1,000. If I'm occasionally impulsive and volatile, that's Camden. It's an attitude. Murder is never far from my mind. The New York influence filters it into sarcasm. Okay, so... I refrained from attending President Obama's visit to Camden this past Monday. I haven't set foot in Camden since I buried my adoptive mother back in 2000. And I have no plans to visit anywhere in the foreseeable future. Walking while white is a capital offense in that town. Walking while white is a capital offense in that town. The last time I tried it, I got a big dose of, what you doing in my neighborhood, white boy? Followed by a beer bottle to the back of my head. In Camden, you learn fast and early that racism is an equal opportunity employer. If you're driving through Camden and homeboys start swarming in front of your car, do not stop. Run them over. It isn't racist to want to survive. Remember Reginald Denny. You guys remember Reginald Denny? No. I have a statement to make. You know what? Al is like an alcoholic. You're sitting in the bar and you've got 5 hours. He just keeps telling you stories about his life, you know, and referring to the sort of the same themes, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what he is.
Piss and moan. Piss and moan.
Piss and moan? This is like Kiskwa, New Ohio, where you're from. It's the kind of people you meet.
Yeah, there's a tear in his beer, and he needs another.
Yeah. No, it's like he just keeps going on about how he had no problem killing people, you know.
I know.
If it comes to that in America, he's ready for the new America.
Of course, he won't know because he'll be crying and talking about when it does happen.
I don't see him crying. He just, he's a good talker, and he's telling you about his life. His life is quite significant to him. He thinks you should know about it.
I don't, by crying, I should be more specific. I mean whining.
Yeah, but he's not irritatingly whining. I'm just sort of maybe thinking, he's a guy that you could sit and he would just keep talking to you. You'd have to listen. And he'd just keep telling you all these different stories. That's the way he's writing here, it seems to me, right?
Yeah, like,
you know, like some drunk will say, yeah, President Obama, he was here last week. I didn't go. You know, he'd go on about why he didn't go, as if you cared. What'd you say, Eliza?
I said, yeah, like he has a lot to say.
He has a lot to say, but it's a very... He's a weak version of me. It's the world is all about Alan. It's all about Alan, really. He's got the huge megalomania here. He does think he's God's gift to sanity and rational human behavior, while being a hedonistic indulgent guy, indulging in all the sins, heroin addict, whatever. Well, he doesn't do heroin, but he does everything else, and the better for it. Okay, so nobody remembers Reginald Denny, right?
Never heard of him.
All right.
Remember the name.
Black.
That sounds familiar to me.
Well, are you going to be quiet, Sarah? Do I have to mute you? What do you think, Sarah? Let's open this. Let's be transparent. Are you going to be able to be shut up for the next 5 or so minutes while you read the story? What do you think?
Yes, it probably just has a familiar sound.
What? I don't even know what you meant there. You're muted.
I know. I'm easily distracted by familiar sounds to me. So go on, Bob.
Oh, hell. I thought I muted you. Oh, there's two of you. There's always two of you now. These guys gang up. So you click off one and the other one still there. Tag team. Okay. Black Lives Matter, in quotes. Black Lives Matter is the slogan du jour these days. It'd be nice if the black community took it to heart. The cops are running a distant second to young black men when it comes to murdering young black men. It isn't about race. It's about culture. Racism became obsolete the first time Francis Crick dropped acid. Black culture, now he's the guy who did the DNA. So, and yes, he did take acid apparently. So why? Why? What? It's genetic? Okay, so it's not based on your skin color, it's based on genes? Is that what he's saying here? Not sure. Black culture in America began to decline with the release of the movie Superfly in 1972. I did see that movie. The glorification of the pimp in black culture was a significant bad omen and led directly to the rise of gangster culture. The pimp is a funhouse mirror reflection of the slave owner. The pimp is a funhouse mirror reflection of the slave owner. Slave owner, just as the bling-obsessed gangsta is the distorted minstrel version of the white nouveau riche of the 1980s with their ostentatious Vanity Fair displays of wealth. The pimp is a funhouse mirror reflection of a slave owner. just as the bling obsessed gangsters is the distorted minstrel version of the white nouveau riche of the 1980s with their ostentatious Vanity Fair displays of wealth. The black civil rights movement in this country was sabotaged in every possible way by genocidal white racists embedded at the highest levels of government. It always brings in a conspiracy angle. Warehousing the poor in housing projects is and always was a truly shitty idea. Warehousing the poor in housing projects is and always was a truly shitty idea. McLuhan would agree with that. Who are the role models for the children in these projects? There are no doctors, lawyers, or architects living there. The models of success in the projects are pimps, extortionists, and drug dealers. The FBI's COINTEL program and systematic assassination of competent and honest black leadership led to the disintegration of the best efforts at responsible community organizing and very deliberately expedited the ascent of self-interested toe cutters and racial arsonists like Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and Louis Farrakhan. The McLuhan said in the late 60s that the blacks would be eliminated. Now, that didn't happen, but it was done very, very skillfully through the prisons and that been imprisoned, or what is it, punished. And this project is pretty interesting, eh? That's
yes.
Part of it. Put them in projects where they get no role models. It's a way of slow, not obvious, what's the word? Genocide.
Yes.
Now, when Alan says that McLuhan is the Andy Warhol of big science, would he know that some of his apparently cynical statements are included and go further by McLuhan? McLuhan goes further than Alan? This is what I like to turn people on. Okay, you think you're hip? You think Marshall McLuhan's some professor? Had a few namby-pamby media ideas. No, man, he understood the conspiracy way beyond you guys. He even said the blacks were being eliminated. And most people say, no, it didn't happen. Well, Bert, as minister of our reverend of our black caucus, are the blacks being eliminated in the United States?
It's, I would say yes, but it's at a different level than when someone thinks. When someone thinks eliminated, they think that it's total. Chemical body relation?
Right.
Related?
Right.
But yes, actually everyone's been eliminated when you look at it from...
Yeah, that's a good point. When you get to Bob's level, it even goes further
yes.
than McLuhan. But let's go back to the within realm of sanity. Do you and your buddies... Well, you're not around black people as much over in Switzerland,
no,
right?
Not at all.
But did you remember conversations 20 years ago with your brothers about... what they were doing, what I was doing to you and your people?
Well, yes, it's always, but a lot of people didn't really want to hear that, or they wanted to sort of like the reaction that happened in Baltimore. Everybody wants to fight, go out in the street,
Rather than what? Than talk about it?
Rather than talk about it, yes.
So they're waiting for the fight to start.
Yes. That's why when I call the thing Baltimore, it's sort of like, reminds me of the 60s, actually.
Right. It's interesting. We're just now reading this column, and it becomes slightly relevant to recent news.
Yes.
But, you know, to gangster culture, I don't get too upset about it, but if I start thinking about the role of traditional culture, what a bunch of bullshit gangster culture is. But... I can understand it as a response to black to tactility. You know what I mean? I can understand it in media dynamic terms. It's totally, it actually communicates to young people in a cloning ESP world, right? It's the iconography exaggerated to deal with the tactile and violent world of the disincarnate disembodied super angels. Totally can explain it that way, but. When I listen to some of this old jazz or this R&B, I don't know if these kids are hearing any of that. They might. Maybe their parents play it for them, but it's actually stupid. You know, this mumbling, these lyrics are just mumbling. Now, they don't even know. I could make a good case. If they wanted to be recognized as a viable culture, I could make a good case on the extension of Tactility Square that they're doing. mumbling is like Finney's Wake.
Yeah.
Finney's Wake is a mumbling, written mumble. But who can understand what they're saying? Okay, so they make the point that, hey, it's a tactile culture, or no verbal semantic meaning necessary, just grunt and yell and scream and babble. Yeah, but if you remain stuck in that, you become specialized. I object to the specialization that these kids end up having. They're stuck in tactility square. They have no ability to communicate in other media, which is a true comprehensive situation.
Yeah, they're more than reacting. They're reacting to it. They're a symptom or showing symptoms of it, but they have no idea what they're inside of or what they're reacting to.
They're accurate. Their response is totally accurate on a sensory mirror level. But you're not supposed to remain embedded in your time. You're supposed to be able to understand other times and periods in other worlds. So I think, and this happens to, you know, all young people. They get stuck in their time. So I object to that. And when I am obviously in charge, we're going to do something about it. The first fucking cultural group that's going to suffer media calls with no electric media is going to be the blacks in the ghettos. I'm taking all electric media away from them. All cell phones, nothing. And they're going to have to go back to school and learn their ABCs. Maybe we'll bring the LaRouches in to teach them geometry, but they're going to get first. Now, we will do it to the other people. We'll do it to the Puerto Ricans. We'll do it to the Mexicans or whatever, the Spanish people, the L.A., the Afghanis. We're going to do it to everybody, one by one. It's going to be some serious media calls. Back to McLuhan. You know, we turn off radio in Venezuela, bomb Afghanistan with books. Turn on the television in Switzerland for 6 months, then turn it off. Modulate the media environments like McLuhan said we should have done it. So we don't. Jesse Jackson's grandson not going to be able to handle this. Louis Farragut's grandson is going to be really pissed off at this. And Al Sharpton's granddaughter will be outraged too, because they'll carry on as dynasties, right? So by the time I take over, I'll be dealing with their grandchildren that they never knew.
And this is the time when
I say it.
And this
the
is the time when
that knew everything before them.
And this is the time a cream cheese person will come in and say, "What the fuck is going on here?"
What kind of person?
You know, someone a craft cheese, someone is just passing by in the cheese radio and they hear you talking like this. They're like, "What the fuck?"
This guy is saying he's going to cancel all electronic subscriptions. No electric media. And he's saying this on electric media. Whoa, that guy. I'm out of here. Yes, then finally, the last people to suffer media callsy will be the Achieve Radio audience. We are going to take the radio away from them. See how they handle that. So here we go. Carrying on. I like that. Self-interested toe cutters. Is that, do they cut people's toes off? Is that what they're talking about? And racial arsonists?
That's a new word for me.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. The idea that all white people are racist or that we enjoy some sort of white privilege is itself preposterously racist. Those notions could only emanate from sources completely unfamiliar with European history or the history of the labor movement in America. Go tell the miners of Harlan County, Kentucky, about white privilege. As far as racism goes, the native peoples of Earth were slaughtering each other for over 1,000 years before the American experiment even began. The idea of white people as a monolithic force is absurd. We hate each other. The idea of white people as a monolithic force is absurd. We hate each other. The white people hate each other. The English hate the Irish and the French. The Irish and the French hate everybody. The Germans hate the Poles. The Ukrainians hate the Russians. The Danes and the Swedes hate each other. The Nordics hate the Mediterraneans. And they all hate the Jews. Hatred comes as naturally to the European mindset as farting. It's got nothing to do with race. It has to do with culture and language. People who can't distinguish between ethnocentrism and racism should shut the fuck up about both. That was a nice rant. Now, this is what Dave Worcester told me, the anthropologist, somebody, talk to the Aboriginal peoples, and they said the one thing they couldn't get rid of was hate. So hate is natural. It's contrast. Everybody hates everybody constantly all the time, other than those pockets of decency that show up whenever Karen and I walk into the room. Other than that, you're dealing with hatred. And we hate you all, but you don't know that when we walk into the room. You think we love you. Well, we even got a God that says we don't give a fuck about you. What God does that? We're not here to help you. We don't want to make you happy. That's the ultimate racist hate fucking ideology you ever heard.
And cancer is good.
Yeah. Cancer is good. Oh, you're out of a job? Good. You have no money? Good. You're going to live under a bridge? Oh, great. You're on your way. You're on your way to ascension. Let's read that again. As far as racism goes, the native peoples of Europe were slaughtering each other for over 1,000 years before the American experiment even began. The idea of white people as a monolithic force is absurd. We hate each other. The English hate the Irish and the French. The Irish and the French hate everybody. Interesting. The Irish and the French hate everybody. The Germans hate the Poles. The Ukrainians hate the Russians. The Danes and the Swedes hate each other. The Nordics hate the Mediterranean, and they all hate the Jews. Hatred comes as naturally to the European mindset as farting. It's got nothing to do with race. It has to do with culture and language. Well, it's starting to get into media there. People who can't distinguish between ethnocentrism and racism should shut the fuck up about both. Now, I would say it's the white race that makes technology, led it in out of Europe. And technology upsets everybody's identity and causes hate. So I think I've just figured it out why everybody in the white race hates each other. Because they're in the most radically upsetting world all the time. Always new technologies. You know what I mean? You get that? Look at the printing press.
I don't think it's just the white race. I think...
Oh, yeah. It is true that it affects everybody. But the whites had the most technology for themselves for the longest time. They brought in the printing press, and you had the 100 Years' War between the Protestants and the Catholics, the Huguenots. I mean, it's just, once you get the printing press, the next 500 years is just hell. War, war, war. And it's not happening in the United States or America on that level. There might be some tribal bashing going on here and there, but they're not doing it at the level of the techno zombies, the white people. What do you think of that? That's a pretty original idea there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We like it.
Yeah, because it's honest what he's saying about the white people beating each other up, but he doesn't know the causes. Now let's see if he does approach something with his causes. What's he going to say? This is a problem with cynical writing. Booze talk. They don't see. This is why I'm the greatest thinker, actor, every fucking thing you want to be today. Because I actually have answers to old questions. New answers for old questions and new answers for new questions. And new questions for new situations. I mean, that is interesting that the white people are pretty violent. But he says it has to do with culture and language. Well, he's on the right track there. But you could easily make it say it better. It has to do with the techno culture. I mean, look at what happened to Europe in the 20th century. I mean, you know, the Iroquois, did they wipe out the Cherokee? No. 6 million Jews. Imagine that. 6 million people. You have that in your resume. Well, as a nation, we did this, we did that, we lost in World War I. Now we got back in World War II. We wiped out 6 million people. And then Mr. Stalin, he was a genius. He killed 30 million people. Not bad. Not bad for our culture. I mean, look at that. Killing all these millions of people just because that Marie Antoinette lady, what's her name? Marie Henrietta, the estranged wife of Leopold of Belgium. I don't know if Leopold II or whatever, she invented all the technology led to radio. She's made the radio create devastation. And then the radio went down to the South America, and you had that madness in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s in Latin America. A lot of death going on there with the death squads. More white people with their technologies. Okay, so let's see if he comes up with anything. If you want to find out who the most vicious... What?
I was going to say, you'll like the next paragraph.
Oh, you've already read ahead?
Just that one paragraph.
Yeah. Hey, you watch yourself. I'm white. I can get fucking pissed off. I can get violent. You're just an Afghani. You're a fake white. I don't know what you guys. Half brown, half white. What are you guys? Are you real white?
You're open to Hobab, so you can be as white as
you
can.
Oh, that's right. I'm a goddamn alien.
You.
Would you say you're not afraid of me?
That you can be as white as you say you are. I'm not afraid of you. You're a Hobab.
No, wait a minute. You said, I didn't get, you're missing a noun or something. Do that again. I can say I'm as white as I want to be, and you're not afraid of me? Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, are you white? Is Afghanistan considered brown, like Indians, like Asian Indians?
No.
What are you guys?
Browns, Pakistanis, they're like brown. We are closer to Middle Eastern, the color of the Middle Easterns, who are closer to white. So we're
close
not
to
like
Hawaii,
brown.
Did you say? Did you say close to Hawaii? I don't think you said that.
No, white, closer to white. Like Middle Easterners, they can pass for
white,
most of them, yeah, because their skin is white.
But
we're
your
not.
Skin is slightly brown.
No. The majority of I don't know, because there's some Afghans who are, they're not as brown as Indians. Indians are dark. Indians, Pakistanis, they're darker. They're more on the brown side. We're closer to the Middle Easterners, but most of them are not as white as them.
Right.
Like they're an in between.
Are the Middle Easterners white?
Yeah, most of them are white, like Turkish, Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
They're pretty white.
Right. And Afghani is like that.
We're closer to them, yeah.
Yeah. Are you surrounded by brown people, like India? Is that nearby?
Well, Pakistan is our neighbor, and India is next to Pakistan. And our other side, on our right-hand side, is Iran.
So that's where the whiteness comes from. You guys gravitated more towards the Middle East.
More towards because when Afghanistan was first conquered, they were first conquered by the Turkish Empire.
Ottomans. And they didn't conquer the Indians.
I don't think they went that far.
Right. Okay. Okay. So. He says, if you want to find out who the most viciously racist people in America are, look to the new immigrants. Whose neighborhoods do they avoid? In whose neighborhoods do they choose to reside? Now, they live in their own neighborhoods? Like, what does that mean, the most viciously? They stay to themselves? What's he saying there? He's saying the immigrants are racist. Do they avoid, is racist just for black? Do they avoid the blacks?
I don't know.
I think.
I would say not just the blacks. They would just avoid.
I'm thinking what I picked up, the Italians are quite proud of their anti-black, right, Bert? Is that true? Hey, look
not
at this.
That I'm aware.
Iris,
not them.
Ira just Skyped in, and I clicked on it, so I might have cut off my Achieve Radio. She just invaded me. I don't know where she is. Ira, like, is it going to show her phone? I mean, I don't know why it came to me. So I don't know where Bill is, what he's going to do about that. I clicked on it, you know? No, it's never, No one's Skype has ever come to me during the show, but it just did. So I thought it was Bill for a second. Let's see if I can play a song, see if it goes over. Yep. Okay, I can still play music. I don't, but that's within the radio. I don't know if I can play my stuff. Okay, so what's he trying to say? Now, what struck me is the Italians. I think that in New York City, I noticed the Puerto Ricans, the Italians, they do not do political correctness, it seems, on the street. They're proud of hating each other. Now, here's Erica doing it again. I'm not doing it, Ira. You know, you screw me up. What do you think? Think I'd do it again? Oh, there she is. She didn't stay. Well, I'm looking at Ira. You want to speak, Ira? How do we hear her? I don't know what she's doing. She's just frozen there. Ira! Oh, well. I can't be distracted by this. We got work to do. Are you ready, Bert, to explain to me how the Puerto Ricans and Italians love to hate blacks and blacks hate them? Do you know about that?
I'm not aware of that, about hating. I mean, it's
Well, not hating. They're proud of their, I don't know, distrust of each other.
Maybe the Italians and blacks, but the Puerto Ricans, I'm not really familiar with Puerto Ricans hating blacks, or maybe I'm not really, was never really exposed to that, but I was always used to them hanging out with each other.
Yeah, in the New York ghettos, they're all mixed together, but.
Yeah.
So, I have to confess, not up on that part. Let's see. So what's he saying? If you want to find out who the most viciously racist people in America are, look to the new immigrants. Whose neighborhoods do they avoid? In whose neighborhoods do they choose to reside? Well, who do they avoid?
Well, they avoid, like, they try to avoid ghetto areas.
Yeah. And there is a, there's an animosity between Koreans and blacks, right? In L.A.?
Oh, that's probably almost every city, because they own stores, like storefront, corner stores, cities.
Yeah. Okay, so anyways, he says, the most effective genocides degrade the target culture to the point where the group under attack destroys itself. The most effective genocides degrade the target culture to the point where the group under attack destroys itself. Look at the Navajo. Suicide rates among young black men have tripled in the last 10 years. The inherent nihilism of gangster culture is doing a far more effective job. Oh, look at that. Effective job, black genocide, than any gas chambers or cop violence could ever accomplish. So he sees that. He sees this subtle reverse genocide. I believe that this is a direct result of social engineering. It behooves us to remember that the primary goal of the CIA mind control experiments of the 1950s-60s was not the creation of mind control Manchurian candidate assassins. It was control of public opinion and large groups. The King family proved that the government was complicit in the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. in civil court in 1999. The King family proved that the government was complicit in the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. in civil court in 1999. That's not conspiracy theory, it's conspiracy fact. So, he understands that the McLuhan, he's sort of giving the way McLuhan's prediction is unfolds. Reverse. Yep. Now, LaRouche was on to this attitude 20, 30, 40 years ago. He understood that. He's always taken this position. Like, he'll say, you go into the ghettos and get the kids listening to classical music, but doesn't really have much far-ranging effect. So what do you think of that? Is that a new idea for you? That the master culture is doing your race in, Bert?
Now, that was always like an unwritten knowledge to people. Most people who were exposed to reading and really taking in a lot of things were aware of that, yes.
Right. So when you went to high school, were you in an all-black school?
No. No. I was actually the beginning of integration. When I was in elementary school, I was on a segregated bus. I went to school on a bus with high school students. We were all black, and we were dropped off at the different schools when the integration first started in the 60s.
So the bus was all black?
Yes.
But you went to integrated schools?
Yes, at first. When I first started going to elementary school was when segregation started, and all the blacks were on one bus and dropped off to the elementary, junior high, and high school.
You said segregation, you mean when integration started?
Well, integration started, yes, but we were in a segregated bus.
Oh, really?
When I first started.
And what's
school.
That? 67, 68?
About 67, 66, 67, around that time,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so were you living in ghettos?
No, I lived in the country, not really a ghetto, but just lived in the country where only black people lived. And, you know, the bus came out and picked us up and took us into the city and dropped us off into the schools.
Integrated schools?
Yes.
So did you experience integration? Did you make any white friends?
Yes. Yes.
So it was pretty relaxed?
Yeah, it was pretty relaxed because I'm a product of mixed race, so they didn't know if I was Puerto Rican, Cuban, or whatever, you know. So,
right.
You know, I looked different, so I was treated different by everyone.
And that's so in the smooth 60s, smoothed
right.
Over.
Yes.
By the 80s, 90s, paranoia's come back in, tribal violence. So if you went back to your school, it might not have been as pleasant now or 10 years ago. It was your day. Do you know about that?
Well, actually, you're saying in the 80s? In the 80s? It's totally different. It was totally different because I actually did some substitute teaching in the late 70s and early 80s, and high school was totally different.
Because they didn't have a segregated bus.
Right. Everything was just free-flowing, so it was a total different environment as far as integration racism. You may have seen some racism, but it was total chaos.
Right. So his vision, Alan Cabal, about the racism in culture in America may not apply to the schools around the United States.
It may depend on what parts. It depends on what parts. I mean, if you go further south, then yes, you may like what he's describing. I remember I went to school with some guys from Camden. Camden's pretty rough. Historically.
Yeah. When he says New Jersey.
Yeah, all of New Jersey is rough.
Yeah. CIA mind controls was not creating Manchurian candidate assassins. It was control of public opinion in large groups. That's slightly getting into tetrad management.
Yeah.
And I've said that MK Ultra is really on the tetrad management level. So see, here's the problem, is that Alan, he could refine his knowledge if he sat at my feet for a while.
Like the rest of us minions.
Yes, like the rest of you. You lucky ones. But you can refine, like he's correct sort of up to the point, but you can get stuck. He's basically still looking at chemical body pre-
yes.
Chip body mind control. You know, it's it is sort of like a conspiracy view, but you have to realize the complexity now, and McLuhan's the way into that complexity. So you would get out of your cliche thinking. I mean, he's doing hipster cliche thinking.
Yes.
And what else? Ion has made a lot of references to the movie Hairspray, and that movie was supposed to take place in the 60s, too.
Yeah, late 50s, early 60s, during the Baltimore Sound. And one of the main great musicians of Zappa's band, Robert Martin, he grew up there and played as a young musician, you know, teenager, with all the great R&B groups and that that came out of there. That's quite a musical history to be part of all that exciting music that the kids were into. And he's there making it, meeting all the artists, and then he goes on to play with Frank. I mean, that's the most ideal musical trajectory I've ever heard of. You know?
Yeah.
To, you know, as a teenager, you'd want to be hanging out with all the great music of that period and being part of it and being good enough to play on the records. And then evolve to working with Frank. Robert Martin. I should post where what he's doing today. He's a slightly health guru. Let's see if I can find that. I think he's a juicer. Robert Martin, health, Zappa, object mentor. Robert Martin, Zappa, juicing. You know, he was married for a while to Cindy. Who's the one who was in the last picture show? Oh, there he is. Do you know Cynthia? She had a TV show for a long time in the 90s or in 2000. She had a comeback from the 70s. Nobody knows.
Are you talking about the actress from Hairspray? I'm not sure.
Yeah, Cynthia.
Oh, wasn't that Ricky Lake?
No. She's not in Hairspray. Bobby Martin hooked up with her in the 90s or something. Well, let me see if his bio goes into biography.
Yeah, I just see one line, Robert Bobby Martin, multi-instrumentalist and vocalist, joined the Mothers in the summer of 1981.
Yeah, he was music director for Bette Midler, performer of Paul McCartney, Mike McDonald, Stevie Nicks, Boz Scaggs, Etta James, Patti LaBelle, Bonnie Raitt. We played Bonnie Raitt tonight, Kenny Loggins. Now, it's not naming the main one. Cynthia, does it say he married her? It's got a list here somewhere in here. Look, he played with, in addition to recording his own solo album, he recorded with Prince, the Moody Blues, Lyle Lovett, Gladys Knight, Glenn Frey, Bobby Caldwell, Michael Bolton, David Sanborn, The Stylistic, The OJs, Sheila E., The Blues Brothers. Wow, isn't that incredible? It's all incredible because he ends up with Zappa. That's the... the show was called Sybil Shepherd.
Oh, okay.
Sybil Shepherd?
Yes.
He was married to her for a while. And I talked to him at the Zappanally in 2011. And I said, why did you split up from her? And it was basically she was addicted to her TV body. It was all about her more than him. Sort of like incapable of having a relationship. More concerned about their career, their TV image. So they split. With visionaries like Frank Zappa as a mentor, Robert has delved ever further into the realms of cutting-edge technologies and musical sound design. For him, the studio itself has become yet another instrument among the many he already plays so well. Now, we got to find his exercise stuff. How do we do that? Juicer. Are we moving along fast enough? Are we providing exciting radio, or is this too casual?
Good, Steve.
It's good. It's good.
Yeah. I'm awake. That's all that matters to me.
Yeah. Right. Now, though it might be a secret link. I'll have to see. So what we've done that. Oh, wait. I didn't finish it. There's another paragraph. The King family proved that the government was complicit in the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. in civil court in 1999. That's not conspiracy theory, it's conspiracy fact. Presidential platitudes about hope and change are as empty as Camden's tax base and won't change a thing. 1 week's worth of the funding we're throwing at our endless war efforts in the Middle East could solve all of Camden's problems almost immediately. As homeboys want to say, show me the money. Obama got out of Camden before dark. He isn't stupid. You know, he did this. Obama got out of Camden before dark. He isn't stupid. Now
there is an interesting line. He says, the pimp is the funhouse mirror reflection of the slave owner. That's like the cliche, you become what you fight against.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
You become what you behold. They became what they beheld is what the Bible says, I think. So you've got, he's saying, I've been refined by my experiences in New York City, but he didn't talk about New York at all.
No.
He just talked about what? He talked about the crude areas, the non-New York world. Yeah, Camden.
And that's New Jersey, so. He really didn't talk about New York, although there are New York influences probably in Camden, but he didn't talk about New York directly.
Right. He says, I refrained it, I haven't said, so he goes into talking about Camden after saying the New York influence filters his rage into sarcasm. So it's erroneously titled. Or I was looking for him discussing some of the interesting things about New York. But he says that in many other columns. He goes into aspects of what New York did for him, who he met. But Camden. Okay, so shall we go to the New Jersey Devil? The elusive Jersey Devil. Nah, it's the most bizarre cryptid in the annals of cryptozoology. When I read that, it was kind of boring. You want to read it, Eliza? You want to read it out loud? Not very
read
long.
Read out loud? Is
yeah,
it
you read it. Yeah.
Okay.
It's only five paragraphs. I read it. Right. Boring. I'm not that interested in it.
Most of the dark cryptid in the annals of...
What'd you say? Most of us aren't?
No, it's reading the
title.
Underneath the title.
You're
okay,
reading
the elusive, the elusive Jersey Devil. The most bizarre cryptid in the annals of cryptozoology.
Yeah.
The New Jersey Pine Barrens are America's secret garden, a million-acre protected wilderness virtually unknown to outsiders aside from random botanists, geologists, anthropologists with an interest in the obscure. The people who dwell there, known as Pinees, are reclusive and not known for being particularly forthcoming to visitors. They have a rich folklore tradition which has only recently begun to be properly documented. The one legend that is well known and thoroughly documented is that to the Jersey Devil, certainly the most bizarre cryptid in the annals of cryptozoology and one of the most enduring. Prior to 2013, the only truly definitive texts on the subject were the two collaborations between James F. McCloy and Roy Miller Jr., The Jersey Devil and Phantom of the Pines, both currently out of print. Those two books dealt exclusively with sightings of the ridiculous creature, in particular the incredible rash of instances throughout the Delaware Valley in 1909,
when they went on some kind of rampage, observed by policemen, university professors, a posse organized for its capture, and an entire streetcar full of people in Philadelphia. A University of Pennsylvania professor who saw it declared it a jabberwock. A jabberwocky. Most described it as a bat-winged flying kangaroo, apparently given to making a horrific sound, much like a woman's scream. Oh, we have a jabberwocky.
Yep, very good.
The legend dates back to 1735 in Leeds Point, just across the marshes and the bay from Atlantic City. According to the tale, Japhet Leeds' wife, Deborah, having already birthed a dozen offspring, became pregnant with a 13th child. Feeding and caring for 12 had exhausted her maternal instincts, and she cursed the 13th child before its birth. Let it be a devil. And so it was, quickly transforming into the bat-winged monstrosity all New Jerseyans knew and loved, flying up the chimney into a storm, forever after to terrorize visitors and residents of the Pines, paying occasional visits to adjacent communities and visiting Philadelphia on special occasions. So, a distant relative of the Beast, Bill Sprouse, has given us a marvelous and meticulously researched work on the subject, The Domestic Life of the Jersey Devil, or Bebop's Miscellany, subtitled An Immodest Inquiry into the Origins of the Leeds Devil, with remarks on the Keithin Affair, Titan Leeds, Ghost Deborah Leeds, Last Will and Testament, Benjamin Franklin, Quaker Refugees, Pine Rats, The Great Woolzebug, Visit of 1909, Harry Leeds Performance Art, Suburban Identity Crisis, NC, inspired by conversations with my grandmother, Helen Leeds, Oyster Eye Publishing, blah, blah, blah. Sprouse's Gonzo approach to the subject provides a delightfully amusing counterpoint to the often dry but thorough account he gives of the conflicts that led to the demonization of Daniel Leeds, a renegade Quaker and father of Japhet Leeds, supposed progenitor of the legendary Beast. He interjects contemporary interviews and wanderings with an extraordinary, well-researched account of the historical context that gave birth to this enduring fortune phenomenon. His descriptions of both colonial and contemporary Piney culture are vivid and accurate, dispelling denigrating myths and pseudoscientific frauds that have persisted for centuries. His personal reflections on his own origins are reasons for pursuing the subject after an enlightening insight into the restless malaise that often afflicts those who are raised in the suburban tracts that abut to the Pine Barrens. It's a remarkably entertaining, informative book and a must-have for anyone interested in early colonial American history, the Pine Barrens, or the erratic and absurd cryptid known as the Jersey Devil.
Very good. There was, I'm just going to read his personal, his descriptions of both colonial and contemporary Piney culture are vivid and accurate, dispelling denigrating myths and pseudoscientific frauds that have persisted for centuries. His personal reflections on his own origins and reasons for pursuing the subject offer an enlightening insight into the restless malaise that often afflicts those who are raised in suburban tracts that abut the Pine Barrens. So I was talking to somebody the other day about, they live in New Jersey. I said, do you know about the Pine Barrens? And they said, yes, they have a sister who lives down there. And she says, the people, a lot of autism, a lot of oddness, a lot of something else, and the people keep to themselves. She had the relatively negative view of the area.
Mm-hmm.
That's how she knew it.
If he mentioned Jabberwocky, you think he read Finnegan's Wake?
Well, Jabberwock is Lewis Carroll, Jabberwocky. I'm sure he's looked at Finnegan's Wake. He's probably checked out everything. He wouldn't have read it much. He wouldn't have mastered it. He wouldn't have. He probably has a bad thing to say for it. Hipsters don't
what
like
do
Phineas Wake.
Oh.
It's too
bad for them.
Ridiculous. It's too obsessive, too excessive. It apparently appears to be excessive. Because hipsters are word people. And they would just see this ridiculous, excessive amount of wordage and not know the McLuhan part of it.
Yeah, they probably find it frustrating.
Yeah. And hipsters don't like to be stupid. They don't like to be less than. So Phineas Wake would make them feel less than. So they'd come up with a reason to dismiss it. Okay, so we did that. Now what?
Now what? What do you have prepared for us, Mr. Bob Dodd?
That was it. What do you have prepared for me?
Hey, Bob. Is Mike Dyer still in contact with you, or?
Not much. Occasionally he'll post on my Facebook. I don't look at his Facebook too much. No, not really in touch, though. If we get in touch, it's all friendly and nice talk. But I don't think he's interested. It's interesting to bring him up. He's like a hipster. He doesn't like my kind of stuff. He definitely wouldn't go into Phineas Wake. He, what else? I don't think he liked Zappa that much. He didn't understand why I made a big deal out of Zappa. He's sort of a nice hipster. So he wouldn't understand Manipian satire, I don't think. Too hard edge for him. He has a soft heart kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember he got mad at the Church of Genius because they started putting a lot of porn kind of pictures in their magazines, and he thought that was anti-feminism, you know, anti-woman. So he could be considered your typical well-meaning liberal. I mean, he's all those years with me, he never let on, and he never showed any interest in what I was interested in.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He never looked into McLuhan, as far as I know. He just found our interplay was charming. He liked that. He liked the fact that I made his show interesting. And he was interested in that. He's a people watcher. He runs a TV station, or a community TV station, or he did for a while, but then they maybe moved. But he's not, he doesn't, for me, he doesn't call me, he doesn't call people. People call him.
Hmm.
I would say he's a passive megalomaniac. You know, a passive, kind, fair, balanced, liberal megalomaniac. I used to always mock him. I knew he was sitting there with that attitude, and put up with my evergreens and all this stuff. Thought it was rather silly. I had to put up with his superiority complex the whole time. I'm in the studio looking at him, trying to out-sneer him in a happy way. We're both happy guys trying to sneer at each other. I think people they used to go nuts over our interaction. They'd find it hilarious, and I don't know if I thought, well, I was funny, but I didn't know if our interaction was hilarious. I thought Michael did it, but maybe people saw the mutual sneering going on. They could hear it, you know. Maybe that's what they liked.
Yeah.
Like once, I think of this. This woman had a show, I think I mentioned her before, and I made fun of the title of her show. She happened to walk in one time. I was on the radio, and I saw it, so I made fun of it. It was called Art on Air, so I was making fun of it. I found out the next day she complained to management and basically wanted me fired.